Hello and welcome to Hysteria. I'm Erin Ryan.
And I'm Alyssa Mastromonaco.
Alyssa, let's talk about the second scariest thing that's happening right now. Halloween.
What? Yes.
How are you dressing slash how did you dress?
Okay, not dressing. I'm instead watching the new Martha Stewart documentary. It's an actual plan. Gina, if you're listening, you know what we're doing. That's our Halloween plan.
Well, you know what? You know an egg white hates to see her coming. So there you go. We are, Josh and I are going to be Ghostbusters.
Yes.
That came together at the last minute because Juniper wanted to be Flounder. And so the baby is dressing as Ursula. And my mom made those two costumes. But then Juniper decided she wanted to be Buzz Lightyear after we did like a bunch of Halloween activities. She's like, I want to be Buzz Lightyear. So we're like, okay, I guess Josh and I don't have to do like Little Mermaid themed costumes.
Right.
Which is fine because I am not going to be putting on a clamshell bikini. I would have been like, I would have been the murderous chef if I would have been if I would have had a Little Mermaid costume. So we were just like, let's just be Ghostbusters. And so we're doing that. So we've got Buzz Lightyear, Ursula the Sea Witch, two.
Do you have an ecto pack? Is that what it's called?
I do have a proton pack.
Proton pack. I do.
And it has like batteries in it and lights up. And it has like, it's really an intense Ghostbusters costume. So
I can't wait to see the pictures.
Yeah. We're not matching, but it'll be fine. Last year we were all 80s rock icons.
I remember that.
Yeah. But this year Juniper is like, nope, I have opinions and they're not to go along with what other people want me to do. All right, on this episode, a lot. We get through a lot. We get through a lot every episode, but
we do, but this was particularly dense.
This was particularly
in a good way.
Dense in a good way, yeah. So we're talking about Kamala Harris's closing argument to the American people in front of 75,000 people in Washington, D.C., plus
great
an
night.
Overflow crowd. Very cool. Good speech. Great night. We talk about that Rogan Trump interview and how
we listened so you didn't have to.
Yeah, you didn't have to, and you definitely didn't have to on regular speed. But we will talk about that later. And we have Stacey Abrams as our interview this week. She's wonderful. She's got some insights into what we're seeing in early voting in Georgia and some thoughts about how to handle those long lines at the polls if that's what you're facing in your precinct. And then we have Sandy Petty.
Yeah. Great.
I'm mad at Halloween.
And I like Bridget Everett.
Okay, you're listening to Hysteria, the podcast for people who listen to the Trump-Rogan interview on double speed, because it's funny when men who fancy themselves manly sound like chipmunks, which I guess it's also an argument for listening to Ben Shapiro, which we do not recommend on any speed. But the Rogan-Trump interview, if you must, double speed.
I wish you had told me that before I listened to the whole thing at regular speed.
Alyssa.
I did. Saturday and Sunday were just errands full of Trump and Joe Rogan. Two full days.
Oh my God. I was like, even on double speed, I was like, they're still talking?
They're still talking.
Nobody ever again better tell me that women are the chatty ones when Joe Rogan is putting out like 7-hour podcast interviews.
As Rogan said at one point, the weave got wide.
The weave was wide. But we're not going to start by talking about that in depth. We are going to talk about something a little bit happier.
Mm-hmm.
On Tuesday, over 75,000 people were in attendance at Kamala Harris's rally in Washington, D.C. at the Ellipse, which is the same place, January 6th heads like me will remember, is the same place where Trump held his Save America rally right before that march down to the Capitol where those peaceful people had a love fest.
Love fest.
Love fest, I guess, all over our nation's capital. And they loved
involved broken windows and graffiti and
a few people
violence.
A few people got loved right to death.
Yep.
But Kamala Harris gave her closing argument to the American people in the same place. I consider that sort of a political saging, if you will. She used the opportunity to compare her policy plans against Trump's, contrasting herself as the candidate of change. Alyssa, what did you make of Harris's speech on Tuesday night?
Okay, so you know that in the part of my life when I only did campaigns or when I did campaigns, my job was events. And so I approach with a very critical eye. It's hard to get an A-plus from me. 75,000 people, incredible, peaceful. Everyone got in. The site was so beautiful, like White House right behind her, flags, people. It was 10 out of 10 chef's kiss for the site alone. And then she just gave a really incredible, not too long, everyone could pay attention. I think her speech was actually somewhere in like the 20, 25 minute range. And I think that the closer that we get, the people who have not been paying attention, you know, the speech was East Coast prime time. I think it came on around 7:15. Also, a lot of people were like, why'd she do it so late? Anyone saying that, it's because doors opened at 3 o'clock. And if you want real people who have real jobs to come, you have to do it a little bit later. Because people were saying it was going to conflict with the World Series. And I thought that her messaging was clear. It was concise. The contrast, which is really all you need to be doing right now, it's all cause and effect, right? If you elect him, this is what will happen. If you elect me, this is what will happen. She has the to-do list. He has the enemies list. So I thought that I thought it was an excellent speech. I thought it was a great closing argument. I thought she delivered it wonderfully, and no technical or site flaws.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, who can argue with that? I thought it also. Yeah, she just like looked so powerful and mm-hmm. sounded so powerful, sure of herself. Like, I don't want to shade Hillary Clinton because, whatever, in the past. But one thing that I remember thinking in the waning days of 2016 was that she was always like reaching for something, reaching mm-hmm. for a presence, reaching. She was coached to be something that she couldn't mm-hmm. quite be in public. Now, whether or not that was like the fault of her advisors, I don't know if it was a personal shortcoming. I think she was just told she had to be something that she couldn't.
I think
quite
that's right, because
be.
As soon it's like if you look at it. Hillary's concession speech was one of the greatest, is probably the greatest speech she ever gave. And so I mm-hmm. think that when she had zero fucks left, we saw the real Hillary.
And I also thought her DNC speech this year
totally.
Was great. She had great presence. But I think in the waning days of 2016, it felt like I was watching somebody who couldn't quite be what she was told she had to be. Mm-hmm. Kamala Harris was so confident. And so mm-hmm. it was like, this person is exactly where they should be. She yep. is saying exactly what she needs to be saying. She believes what she's saying. Mm-hmm. She knows that she can do this. And she's like locked in. She mm-hmm. is like, she's cooking, as they said in Crooked Media Company Slack last night. She's cooking. And I thought her message was really good, really mm-hmm. resonant. I'm going to go ahead and say this because I can, because I'm a yapper professionally. Her remarks that we need to lock arms instead of pointing
yeah,
fingers.
I agree.
I think that that is such a healing way for the next leader to view the political divisions that have been sown for the last 9 years in this country. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I feel that generous and forgiving, but I'm glad that the person that I'm supporting for leadership does. I think it's going to take a lot of people at the top who really truly believe that we can heal whatever has rended us apart mm-hmm. in order for that to start to happen. But I'm glad that she has idealism around rebuilding a unified country. I'm glad.
I agree. And also, just to go back to my practitioner ways, I'll tell you this. The night before the election in 2016, Hillary was in Philadelphia, or suburbs of Philly. No, actually, she was downtown Philly.
I remember
this. She had Bruce Springsteen. She had the Obamas. I think Jay-Z was there, too. She had 30 to 35,000 people, if memory serves. And, like, I do believe crowd size doesn't tell you everything, though Donald Trump does think that, which is why he lies about it all the time. Mm-hmm. But to see that many people in a place like in D.C., D.C. is going to be blue. D.C. is blue. Maryland is blue. Like, these were not people who, themselves really needed to come out. Do you know what I mean? Like, they were probably mm-hmm. pretty baked in, like they supported her. But to see that 75,000 people came out, it's pretty
On a school night. Yeah, I was actually the crowd size was jaw dropping to me. Mm-hmm. Having it at the Ellipse was quite a confident move.
Yep.
A confident move.
I love a message venue.
I also read that there was overflow, that they maxed out at 75K, yep. and people were on the National Mall watching her yep. give the speech. And it was just kind of stunning to me because, I live in this sort of like insular group of – I wouldn't really choose to be around Trump supporters given the option yep. of doing literally anything else. But, you know, I'm not in a place where I really have an accurate read of how things are.
Right.
And I just was kind of blown away by how many people were willing to take time out of their day, brave the pain in the ass of going to an event that
totally.
Has that amount of security, stand out there for hours, like, to listen to her give a 20-minute speech. It's like... Mm-hmm. That's really impressive. And I was like, I guess there are things going on that are positive things that I can't see. You know,
yeah, 100%.
I think I always assume that there are negative things that I can't see and they're going to sneak up and get me because I have anxiety and that's what mm-hmm. it is to have anxiety. But also there are positive things out there sneaking around, hiding under
creeping,
your bed.
Creeping.
Hiding under the bed, whispering compliments like, you're doing a great job.
You're and really then smart.
Yes, exactly. It felt like an upside surprise. And yep. that was like really encouraging to see. I did want to point something out, another thing that happened that could be an upside surprise. Did you, by chance, watch the Washington Commanders football game on Sunday against the Chicago Bears?
I did not.
It had one of the greatest endings of any football game of all time. So basically, the Commanders, formerly known as the racial slurs.
Yep.
They were behind the Bears, and mm-hmm. they had the ball, I think, at like the 40, their own 40-yard line. It wasn't looking good.
Oh, I did see this. Yeah.
5 seconds left on the clock. The quarterback, the Bears were already celebrating because it had been a close game. The quarterback for the Commanders steps back, like runs around. Time runs out on the clock. So he's got it, you know, this is going to be the last play of the game. He like weaves around. He waits for a block. He waits, he waits, he waits. And then he just chucks it as hard as he can at the end zone. And there's a group of defenders jump up and they tap it in the air. A Washington Commanders player in the end zone catches it. They win. Here's why that matters. And sorry, that's a dramatic sports recounting. So, Alyssa, the Commanders rule is kind of this odd thing that keeps happening. It is basically that the results of the NFL game closest to the election. So the NFL game involving the Washington football team, the Commanders,
yep.
formerly known as the Redskins,
mm-hmm.
Often correlates with the results of the election. If the Washington football team wins their last home game
mm-hmm.
before, then the incumbent party remains in power in the White House. If the Washington football team loses the
right.
game, the last home game, the incumbent party loses. So there have been some elections where that has not been
yeah.
the case, but most of the time since 1937, it has been the case.
Well, we'll have to see how it nets out this time.
We'll have to see how it all shakes out. I really hope that the final play of the election is not as nerve-wracking and thrilling because I am not a fan of either one of those teams, and my heart almost fell out of my chest. It was so exciting to watch live.
Isn't that exciting? Look, sports and politics.
Isn't that exciting?
In 2004, that is exciting.
Tells us about as much as a poll does at this point.
Look, it's like there are certain states that the way they go is always the way that the country goes. It's like you don't know if that's always true every time, but
yeah,
we'll take it.
I know. That's just a fun little thing. Also, just, you know, if you haven't seen that highlight, it is a really thrill. Even if you don't care about sports, it is a really thrilling moment. So you should go ahead and YouTube that guy because it's fun to watch. Okay. Well, yeah, the speech was great. I'm feeling good, actually.
Yeah.
Feeling as good as I ever have about this election. Going into this final week. Now, unfortunately, we're going to have to talk about something else. I'm going to just say this. This is 100% because my friend Erica from home, hello, Erica, is a listener in a deeply purple state and a deeply red part of a deeply purple state. And she was like, can you please talk about this? And I was like, oh, fine. Whatever I'm about to do for you on this podcast is much less hard than what you have to do every day driving past all those homemade Trump signs in fields. So, Erica, This is for you. Alyssa, take this away.
Well, you and I listened to Donald Trump's interview on the Joe Rogan Experience, so you all didn't have to. The interview was a whopping 3 hours long. And yes.
Wait, Alyssa, did you listen to it on regular speed?
Yes, I told you. I listened to it on regular speed, okay? I didn't know listening on fast forward was a thing, okay?
Oh, my God. I'm going to show you how to do it.
You know. Look, everyone in the studio's laughing at remote Alyssa. She's going to be 49 years old, doesn't know how to use technology. Yes, I listened to it in painfully regular speed. The highlights, if we can even call them that, included Trump dodging questions about his stolen election claims, bragging about his reality TV accolades. There were aliens. There were vaporizing lakes. The reality is that 2 years ago, Rogan called Trump an existential threat to democracy, and now he is platforming him to his tens of millions subscribers. I think as of this morning, that podcast had been listened to over 35 million times. According to both Rogan and the Harris team, he offered to host Kamala on the show, but the logistics were not possible. You can keep Trump and Rogan. We have Beyonce.
Okay, so I'm going to be mean. I'm going to be mean here. I am not, this is not a podcast for me. It's not for me.
I never listened to it before.
Yeah, it doesn't really interest me, but you know, it's fine. Not everything is for me. It's fine. I was struck by how fucking dumb both of these guys are. Just aggressively fucking stupid. And I was like, that was the first thing. I was like, wow. Second thing was that Rogan, given the limits of... He's a very curious person, which I think is why he's good at making a podcast, because he does have like a sort of curiosity. Wow. You know what? Turns out both producers on this show listened at regular speed.
And they are 20 years younger than I am. So that makes me feel much better.
Yeah. The Scorpio persevered and listened to the whole thing. Okay. So the thing is, you know, despite the fact that I'm like, you know, you can kind of hear the squeaking of the brain cells. There is a lot of curiosity there, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But what struck me was how much Joe Rogan was trying to help Donald Trump along on the interview. Mm-hmm. It reminded me a little bit, because it's spooky season, of the scene in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, where they're at the dinner table and the patriarch of the murderous Texas Klan. I'm sorry if I'm spoiling this 1974 movie for you, but you know what? You've had a long time to watch it. The patriarch of the family like really wants to like participate in killing this woman, and like they like help him. They try to like help him do stabbing and stuff. And it was, and it's like, you know, I watched it in a film class in college called Sex and Death in Cinema. And it was, and all we talked about was how it was like a metaphor for like impotence, like watching, you know, these people being like, let's help the old man penetrate this woman. Anyway, great class, great, weird class to take at Notre Dame. But regardless, that's what that interview reminded me of. It was like Rogan was sitting there trying to help Gramps, like, you know.
That is very true.
Like, how to helping him hold the knife, feeding him questions, like, rephrasing his answers in ways that
bringing him back. It felt like, to me, it was like Joe Rogan had a butterfly net and he was trying to catch him the whole time. Mm-hmm. He's like, where are you going? Where are you going? Like, he was taking things. Literally, at one point, Trump was on such a tangent. He's like, sir, can we get back to tariffs? Because I think that's important.
The weave is wide.
The weave was wide. But I feel like, okay, I had a, maybe because I went in knowing less maybe than you did. I had never listened to Joe Rogan. I don't follow him. I really knew nothing about him, except that I think he was on Fear Factor.
Yes,
right?
He was.
Right? Yeah.
He was.
Which I watched. And so.
He's been hit on the head a lot also.
Yeah. So I was interested in the fact, I found it maybe impressive, I guess is the word, that he sat there and conducted a 3-hour interview. Like, mm-hmm. I thought that was interesting. It is worth just mentioning that he did say a couple weeks ago that Kamala destroyed Trump in the debate on his show.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I was like, okay. So I went in with a little bit of an open mind. It is really hard to listen to Trump talk about his time as president for us, right? Like, I guess, like, the podcast wasn't for us. right? Mm-hmm. And so I tried to listen to it knowing that it wasn't for me. But when you hear him talk about foreign policies and how he interacts with leaders, how all the generals are dumb except for, like, he recounted conversations of, like, the time, like, when he, this was of particular interest to me, when he was talking about the trip he took to Afghanistan, and he's, okay, Aaron, I went to Afghanistan 2 or 3 times. I went to Iraq a couple times. Like, I am keenly aware of what he went through to get there. Mm-hmm. And he's talking about it like, he's like, and then they come back. They tell me we got to turn all the lights off. And so we have to turn all the lights off on Air Force One, even the blinking ones outside. And he's telling this story. And I was like, yeah, dude, it's lights. Okay. And you only turn them off. You usually turn them off once you get through Turkish airspace, right? Like that is when you turn the lights off. And so there were particular parts where I was like, I know you're unfit, but you are so unfit. Like you, mm-hmm. And he talked about things like when he got on the ground where the soldiers asked him, they're like, sir, do you want to take a rest? Do you want to go whatever? There's no fucking way that happened. There is no mm-hmm. way. When you get on the ground, you're the president of the United States and you're in fucking Afghanistan, you are in and you are out. No one's taking a rest. But he used it as a vehicle to be like, I'm sure when Sleepy Joe came, he took a 4-hour nap. And it's like, no, he didn't. Like,
he didn't.
There are such unnecessary lies that he tells. And he talks about how he was telling the generals on the ground to override what people in D.C. said and how all the generals on the ground were talking trash about, like, Milley and Mattis and all that. And no, they weren't.
No, they weren't.
They absolutely weren't.
No, they weren't. And the president being like, why don't you just, like, circumvent the chain of command?
Yes!
Is like, what?
It's treason! Like, what are you talking about? Like, there were so many points.
But that's what I mean when I say that Rogan is, like, curious but dumb.
Yeah, because, no, like, he didn't stop any of that. He let him just keep talking. He didn't push back on it. I was mostly just, like, interested when Trump started talking about aliens, and Rogan was like, I'm not sure that's true.
Wait, no. This was the part that really, there are two parts that really got me. Actually, two big parts, and then there were a couple little tells that I kind of want to get into. One was the part when they were talking about how the Rogan suddenly brings up that the middle of California used to be a lake.
Oh, yeah, this was a good one.
But then they conflated these two lakes. There used to be one, like, prehistoric giant lake in the middle of California that just no longer exists as a result of just, like, natural changes in the ecosystem, right? Because it was a prehistoric lake. But what remained of it for a significant period of time and into recent history was a large lake in the Central Valley that was over-irrigated to feed a cotton crop, and cotton should not be grown in Southern California because it's too dry and cotton requires a ton of water. So it was over-irrigated, and then a drought happened and the lake essentially dried up. So in the year, like a couple years ago, when we were having like a ton of rain, there was the possibility of that lake filling up again. And what would have happened if it would have filled up is that towns would have been taken out, And significant crops would have been no longer arable there because they would have been underwater, right? If the prehistoric lake were to be restored, the entire Central Valley of California would be underwater. What happens in the Central Valley of California? About 1/5 of the food that we grow in this country is grown. These two fucking dipshits were sitting there talking about Donald Trump said that they, like, used a faucet to drain it into the Pacific Ocean, which...
Which was crap. And Joe Rogan at that point was like, I don't think so, sir.
Yeah, yeah.
No, sir.
But they just kind of glossed over it. And then Trump floated the idea of bringing the lake back. Like, sir, I'm sorry. What the fuck are you talking about? Like, that is the worst idea I've ever heard. And that was right on the heels of him indicating that he knows very little about agriculture because he was trying to explain to Joe Rogan.
The farmers. I love the farmers.
Well,
the farmers are wonderful.
Soils work for different crops. Can you believe it? Yes, you fucking moron. Have you ever drank wine? They explain to you that soil impacts how wine. That's a fancy
Imagine
rich boy
if
thing.
He asked him what a cover crop was or...
Yeah, I guess he hasn't drank wine because he doesn't drink wine. But you would think that a person that's rich and fancy would know
that soil
impacts crops just through wine. But regardless, so that was really stupid. And then there was the part where Rogan, who does clearly know a lot about UFC fighting and space.
Yep, he does know a lot about space.
He does know a lot about space. He brought up...
Are you going to talk about Mars?
Yes. Yes. Okay.
I knew it.
So Trump says at one point, and if a woman said this, guys, if a woman said
over.
It, it would be clipped and played more than that clip of the Miss Teen South Carolina person that hacky politicians are still citing as examples of being dippy. Donald Trump said that there is no reason to believe that there isn't life on Mars.
Yeah.
And Rogan was like, actually, we have probes there. There's a possibility that, and this was another example of him trying to save Donald Trump. Mm-hmm, he was like, no, we have probes. We've done a lot of tests. There's a possibility that at some point there was life, but there isn't currently life. And Trump is like, yeah, you know, I guess we'll never know. It was just like, oh my God.
Then they started talking about Roswell, and then they started, I mean, it just went on. But the one thing I will say is that I do think it's the best interview Trump has done.
Best in what way?
Best in that he was calm. If you were not listening to the actual words he was saying and only the way he was saying it, I felt like for him coming out of that interview, if you're a Rogan listener and you were maybe on the fence, I feel like it was probably like a low-key net positive for Trump.
I don't know if any Rogan listeners are going to be on the, you know, like, I don't know.
Maybe they're libertarians. I don't know.
I think if you are a person who knows what they're talking about most things, that they would come away from it. And if they're curious, if they lead with curiosity, they would be like, he didn't really get fact checked a lot because Rogan during the interview said he doesn't believe in fact checking. Anybody can nail an interview if you can just go in and say whatever the fuck you want and make shit up. And that's what he did. And
I think it was probably a net positive.
Right. But if you're a curious person and you're like, I wonder if those things are true. There were so many falsehoods that he said. And there was one part with Joe Rogan where Rogan kind of pressed him on, like, if you believe that all of this fraud happened in 2020, then, like, where's the evidence? Are you going to show it? And Trump kind of gives a Sarah Palin-esque answer, like, books. I've got books of it.
Yeah.
And then he cites Molly Hemingway, one of the dumbest bitches in the entire game, and a book that she wrote, which obviously was not enough to convince literally anybody of consequence, including Republican secretaries of state and government officials, that there was any merit whatsoever to Trump's claims that in 2016 and 2020 there was any kind of fraud. Another thing is, like, when he was telling these stories, he mixed up details from the 2 years in a way that is
100%
telling about his ability to recall facts. He told a story about a poll in Wisconsin that he said in 2016 found him down 17 points the day before the election in Wisconsin. That was 2020, and he did lose Wisconsin. So that was kind of crazy. He also, every single number that Donald Trump throws out is basically not true.
Incorrect. It's
exaggeration in a direction. He exaggerated the number of miles of border wall that he built. He exaggerated how many people have been at his crowds. If you notice in the interview, he uses numbers over and over again that you're how is it that 28,000 people were outside of that McDonald's, but also 28,000 people were at a rally? Like, wow, that's what a crazy coincidence that there just happened to be 28,000 people at these two events that you name within 5 minutes of each other. Very weird. He also kind of lied about, he lied about his Las Vegas crowd size. He lied about Kamala Harris being the border czar.
Right.
He lied about Kim Jong-un. He said that he has a great relationship with Kim Jong-un. He met with him 3 times when he was the president, and North Korea is no closer to nuclear disarmament, which was allegedly the point of the meeting. Like, I'm sorry, I'm going off on a tear right now, but...
No, but I mean, he was also like, if I had been president, Putin wouldn't have invaded, and I'm just going to bring them together, and this is what's going to happen. And he was like, but what would you say? Like, how? And he's like, well, I can't tell you. I can't tell you my plan because then my plan wouldn't work.
But then he got into that thing that he got into in the debate with Kamala that was widely mocked, where he was like, don't do it, Abdul. don't
oh,
do
yeah,
it.
Oh, yeah, he brought him back.
Yeah, Abdul was back.
Abdul came back, yeah.
He also said that he was going to call up Vladimir Putin and tell him, like, hey, don't. And he called up Emmanuel Macron and said the same thing.
The Macron thing was crazy. Macron's going to send you a cease and desist.
He called him up and he said, he was like, hey, don't do it. And Macron was like, how can I argue
okay.
with that?
Oh, that was the it was Trump said he was going to put tariffs on all the wine and cheese and that he folded like a house of cards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was completely wrong. I also thought there was he was wrong about global warming. He was wrong about how much the sea level is slated to rise. He said it'll
rise.
He's
wrong about windmills.
He's wrong about windmills. He is right about maybe he should be a whale psychologist, which was something that he brought up. I think that was a joke. Okay. He also was wrong about electric vehicle charging stations and how much they cost, which is a weird
thing. $9 billion.
$9 billion, which is a weird thing for him to go off about, given how much time he spends with, like, Elon Musk. tucked in his armpit like a little clutch bag. It was so weird. But there was one moment toward the beginning of the interview that I want to get to before we move on, because it was just a real flurry of falsehoods in the Rogan interview. I want to point out that early in the interview, Donald Trump says something that's like, oh, one of the questions you're going to ask, I think you're going to ask, is this, which makes me think that he probably got a list of questions in advance from Rogan.
Oh.
Remember that?
Yeah, I didn't really, I got to be honest, I didn't clock that at the time, but yeah, you're right.
Yeah,
right.
I mean, whatever, this is pure speculation, but Trump did say that, and my response was, I wonder if he got the questions in advance, because, you know, that's not out of, I could see a campaign asking for that, but I think that given the questions in advance really undermines the idea of the interview being anything more than, like, something that is meant to help the campaign. Like, you know, if you give the questions in advance, you're trying to help the campaign. And it's fine if you are, but I think that if, you know, it should have been more transparent if that's what they're trying to do. Like, give a campaign appearance. Yeah. Trump, I also love that he lies about his Uncle John, who he says was the longest-serving professor in the history of MIT.
Oh, yeah.
Which isn't true. At least 10 people have been on the faculty for... It's just weird. Just weird things to lie about, right?
Well, it's like, Donald, it's enough. Stop. You're good. Like, it makes me want to go see the Jeremy Strong Apprentice movie, because I feel like he's going to break down everything that Roy Cohn did to Trump that made him, like, this absolutely insecure and insane.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, you know, just breaking as we're doing this, apparently J.D. Vance is going to be on.
Not listen. You know what? I'm really not listening.
I can't. At least Donald Trump is funny. Not when he's not always trying to be funny, but at least it's kind of funny.
No, but it's like I chuckled. There were times I chuckled. I mean, not with him, more at him, but still.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, JD is too, JD, look, Donald Trump is truly dangerous. There's a malevolence to JD Vance that I can't give him the download, Aaron, not even on double speed.
I just, you know, think about the most annoying kid in the debate club. Do I want to spend 3 hours of the life that God has given me on this earth, of the time that I get here listening to a debate club champion try to smarm and bro down at the same time? I listened to him on that one like bro-y podcast where those guys in their 30s try to act like they're 21. I don't remember what it's like a Miami-based dude podcast. And listening to J.D. Vance try to be like, yeah, me and my buddies, blah, blah, blah. It was just like, oh.
J.D., you don't have buddies. None of us believe that.
Are the buddies in the room with us, J.D.?
You don't have buddies. And it's even funny. Well, the thing that's a little funny about it, too, is that after the crazy MSG rally, a lot of Republican ladies are like, you've crossed the line. You are too bro-y.
Mm-hmm.
So I just, a bro-y interaction with J.D. Vance doesn't feel like it's going to help anything.
No, no. And I feel like I can smell that podcast. You know what
Gross.
I mean? I feel like I can smell it. Okay, speaking of J.D. Vance, there was a really interesting piece in The Cut about Usha Vance, J.D. Vance's wife, who has been largely absent from the campaign trail, and kind of what a mystery she is. And also this week, Melania Trump appeared. People were comparing her appearance with Donald Trump, like when two people from Love is Blind meet each other. And the
was
woman,
the funniest
like,
thing. I howled. I howled. Caroline posted it. And Akila posted it. And I couldn't repost it fast enough. I have never seen anything more accurate in my life.
Of all of the married, of all of the women who are not into their husbands, she is not into her husband.
She is the most not into him.
And she doesn't care if everybody knows it. I feel like her, if she has a boyfriend, I feel like he was watching and he was like mad she was going to do this appearance.
And
she
then he like, laughed.
Yeah. And then he was like, okay, well, thank
we're
you
good.
For not.
Thank
yeah,
you.
We're good. So let's talk about first spouses and what they've been up to on the campaign trail. Alyssa, where is Usha Vance doing, and what do you think she's thinking?
Girl, she's missing. She's in the witness protection program. I think the last time we saw her was at the convention.
A couple weeks after the convention, she was like on the tarmac and doing a couple of like campaign stop appearances.
Oh, that's right.
I watched a 10-minute video of them being at like a diner and her sort of like hovering around her children, as JD
her,
would call
her
them.
Children.
Hovering around the children and trying to, like, you know, it was kind of a crazy environment and doing the thing that a mom does, like, okay, guys, let's all,
right.
You know.
Listen, and I have had my share of political spouses, you know, neither one in 2004, Teresa Hines Carey, was not particularly excited about being engaged and being out campaigning. And when Barack Obama decided that he wanted to run for president, Michelle had rules of the road. I mean, she was like, this is what I will do. This is what I won't do. Both of them. And by the way, Mrs. Hines, I mean, was much older than any of these women. And they were out there more enthusiastic. I mean, Michelle aside, like, we'll just talk about Teresa for a minute. But like, more aggressive, more enthusiastic, more present than we have seen Usha or Melania. Like, they're just totally. I mean, Melania, right? Like, MSG is the first time she's been out, except for when she went to the box in the Republican convention, but like at the last minute.
She just
like,
walked
she
through.
She was not.
Like,
she,
go, like this, like an animatronic, like in yeah. Home Alone during the scene when he does the fake party at the house. So the robbers yep. like leave him alone. She was like Michael Jordan on the train, like just riding past the window, waving. Could
and
have
that
been
was
a mannequin.
It.
Could
and
have
that
been a
was
mannequin.
It. And so I feel like they're just, I mean, I think that it is for a political grouping, the MAGA party, let's call them, that's so patriarchal. I think it is hilarious that their wives seem to not really support what they're doing or won't actively, publicly stand next to them when they say the misogynistic, racist things that they say and are willing to double down on to get elected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even though both of those women, in certain ways, I mean, Usha Vance has been the target of, like, vile, racist
right.
garbage. And so I don't blame her for not wanting to be out there or subjecting herself or her family to that. But also, I don't know, I would be pretty pissed at JD if he were my husband doing
yes.
this. I would be like, it is not worth it to me to like have to drag my family, to drag our family into this. Like, what are you possibly doing that is worth what you're doing to us? You know?
That, and the thing about it is that we have read so much about her, ball buster at Yale, you know, a really prestigious lawyer, that like most of these decisions when people run and they're married are a joint decision. Right? Mm-hmm. And I think the thing that's so hard to see is like if she got a vote. I mean, I'm assuming she did, but it doesn't seem that if she voiced concerns that he heard them.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, a very interesting tidbit from the Usha Vance piece, which was by, I believe, Erin Carmone?
Yeah.
Yeah. It was, which is, she's a great writer. I mm-hmm. love everything she writes. One thing that I found very interesting buried in there is that J.D. Vance changed his name when he got married.
Yes.
When they got married, they picked a new last name together. He mm-hmm. thought about taking her last name, but then they picked a new one together that was like a family name for him.
Yep.
but not his given last name. So they both had to go through. There's something really Prague about that. Like, they both went to the name change place. Like, they both filled out the forms. They both had to get new credit cards and new social security cards. Like, he really should have a better understanding of what it is to be a wifey. But he's, I guess, maybe overcome.
Willfully ignorant.
Let's talk about Michelle. Obama is, she is in her DGAF era, I believe.
It's great to see.
Okay. Alyssa, what did you make of her speech in Kalamazoo, Michigan that happened this past week?
So the speech in Kalamazoo felt to me like an even more direct and emotional version of what she did at the DNC, which is, you know, people have to remember, I know we're a long way, you know, 16 years past or so, whatever it is. Donald Trump said Barack Obama was an illegitimate president, our first black president, said he was illegitimate and was not born in America. He created the entire birther.
He didn't create it.
He didn't create.
He doubled
down.
It.
He doubled down on it.
And I don't want to give him credit for that.
No, we're not giving him credit. However, he incited people to be as dangerous towards Michelle and the girls as he ever could have been. And the whole time we were in the White House, look, I oversaw Secret Service. I saw the threats. I know what happened after he doubled down on the claims that Obama was not a legitimate president. And she hates him with the passion of 1,000 fucking suns. And the fact that someone who is so ignorant, who is so unintelligent to her, I mean, to all of us, but I think that her speech was an encapsulation of it, was kind of like, America, how dare you? How dare you hold her to a different standard? You're holding him to no standard. Mm-hmm. And every mistake that Kamala makes is a breaking news alert that we get over our phones. And by the way, 99% of them aren't mistakes. They are observations at best. And Michelle was not having it. And, you know, Michelle does not like politics. She does not like being political. One of the funniest things that I saw that circulated among the OG ladies in Obama land was one of the things where Michelle's going to work her ass off from now until Election Day, because she knows if Kamala loses, everyone's just going to be telling her she has to run every day for the next 4 years, which she will never fucking do. And she was like, no, but here's the thing about Michelle. When you see people out and about and they're just like always campaigning, you're like, you kind of turn a deaf ear. Michelle was always on the campaign, in the White House, on the second campaign. She's always been known as the closer. And when you bring her in, she's like, let me go. And she did. And that Kalamazoo speech was so, she put everything into that. And I think that she's probably like the single best communicator about what's at stake in this election that's on the stump right now.
Mm-hmm. There was a moment in the speech that really stood out to me that got me emotional. And it was when she was pleading to men to see women as human beings.
Yep.
And I got the impression from that, like, there was something so emotional about being like, please see me as a person. Please vote for your daughter's lives. Please vote for the humanity of half of the population. It felt to me, and maybe I'm projecting, it felt to me that the subtext there was, we are not going to ask please anymore. This is the last time
this
we say
it.
Please. Because I think that, like, gender relations in this country are really, like, at the edge of tenability.
Aaron, it's like, I don't know, I don't think we talked about it, but when J.D. Vance, when all the stuff came out again about the childless cat ladies, oh my God, I'm like getting teary. That like really hurt, you know? Like, you're like, wow, there's like someone who just doesn't think I'm a person. And I don't care what J.D. Vance thinks about me, but they believe it. Like, they believe it, and she knows they believe it. So I totally agree about your assessment of that part of her speech. I mean, it was very emotional, and she fucking meant it.
Mm-hmm. I will say this about being a woman, whether or not you have children. I believe that being somebody who thought that I would not have children and now having two, mm-hmm. I think that there are aspects of the human experience that are accessible to us, whether or not we have children, that are just not accessible to people mm-hmm. who are men or who yeah. have never, ever lived as girls or women. Mm-hmm. They're just not accessible. And the arrogance and willful ignorance and stupidity that it takes to think that you are a man and therefore your experience is the default and anything yep. outside of that range of experience is illegitimate is like both stupid and unnecessarily depriving you of understanding the full human experience. Like, are you yeah. fucking kidding me? You really think? I almost feel in a little way, if they weren't such bullies and assholes, I feel sorry for them. I feel sorry for people for men that mm-hmm. cannot see us as full humans and do not understand that the beauty of our experiences and the beauty of our lives are I feel sorry for people who see that as illegitimate. Because and you are like closing yourself off to like so much beauty and meaning in the world.
And joy.
If you don't find
it. Yeah. It's an interesting thing that a couple months ago, it was right after JD was picked as vice president, and he was doing a stand-up press conference, and someone asked him what brought him joy. And the fact he couldn't just say, my fucking kids, mm-hmm. like he didn't have to name them, he doesn't have to trot them out, he can just be like, you know what, my kids bring me joy. Mm-hmm. He came up with some cockamamie answer that
well, I'll tell you what, not the media.
Yeah, that's what he said. And it's like, what is missing from your life and your experience, like as you go through the day, that wasn't the first thing that popped to your mind? Like, if you ask DK what brought him joy, my husband, for those who don't know, 100% he'd be like, the cats. Like, I mean, I'm just saying.
Alyssa, at the time, he had a puppy.
Still don't know what
his. He had three children and a fucking puppy. No, he's had dogs. Like, he's
but
always
no,
had-
He has your assessment of him when he was trying to go up the stairs to the plane with the dog. Oh, yeah. You're like, he's never done this before. He has never had the dog out in public.
Someone else is taking care of the dog, even if that is his dog. Someone else take care of it. But I mean, he had three kids, a devoted wife, and a puppy. And his response was, "I'm mad at the media.
I'm mad at the media.
I feel.
Let
like
me tell you something. As I." Like, refine my stand-up comedy routine here. Yours not funny.
After that, Peter Thiel had to plug J.D. Vance back into his little server and upload a bug patch to whatever part of his program was
malfunctioning. And then his lithium battery exploded.
I mean, yeah. So we're also seeing Gwen Walls and Doug Emhoff on the campaign trails. They have been out as much as Melania and Usha Vance have been hidden away. And I just think it's a testament to the sort of vision that both campaigns have for the future. One of them is a vision of the men just doing whatever the hell they want. And the other one is one of marriages being supportive partnerships.
And you know what else I think?
Mm-hmm.
I think that Tim and Gwen, I think that Kamala and Doug, Aaron, they've got nothing to hide. They're not afraid of what questions the press might ask them. They are totally confident in why they are running and what they believe, and they feel fine being out there. And mm-hmm. when you think about it, it's like Melania and Usha want nothing to do with the press because they don't want to be – like, that's the downside. You go out, you do events, that also means you're subjected to the press. And I just think that they simply cannot answer with a straight face the questions that they would be asked and probably maybe don't want to say the answers they've been coached to say.
Mm-hmm. I also think Melania is sulking and has been sulking from the moment that she realized she'll never be on the cover of Vogue again. She was on like once when she got married to Trump.
And she was the first lady, right, who wasn't on the cover of Vogue.
During her time as first
right.
lady. Yeah, yeah. She's still sulking. She doesn't like the media because she can't be on the cover of Vogue.
Everyone takes their toys and goes home to their Trump tower.
Yeah, if she even lives there, which...
We don't know.
We don't know. We don't know. I mean, I hate to sound like Donald Trump by being like, look, I don't know. I don't know if it's true or not. But I think that the consensus is she doesn't really spend very much time there. No. And didn't maybe even never moved into the White House, which
that was the one thing about the Joe Rogan interview that really stopped me in my tracks. When Joe Rogan asked Trump about Barron and Trump actually had answers to the questions, I was like, oh, maybe he does see him once in a while.
I think he likes Barron because Barron is enormous.
Yes,
and I think
tall.
That he just likes anybody who displays symbols of Trump's, like very simplistic symbols of masculinity that Trump has internalized as legitimate. So if you're a big guy, if you're a strong guy, if you're loud, he likes you.
And that was one weird thing from the Usha profile, that J.D. Vance always describes her as tall. Like that's a thing for him. Do you know what I mean?
Some
I just think that's
like- I actually think that it's kind of cool that he likes tall ladies. It's like the one cool thing about
him. I just think it's interesting that it's like that would be a description.
Yeah. Maybe he's one of those guys who just wants a woman who appears physically formidable and is emotionally and mentally formidable so that he can subjugate them. Maybe that's like part of what he's interested in.
That might be. That might be.
Another episode for another time. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Stacey Abrams.
In moments like these, it's easy to feel overwhelmed and even easier to feel powerless. But we are neither. I'm Stacey Abrams, and on my podcast, Assembly Required, I take on each executive action, legislative battle, and breaking news moment by asking three questions. What's really happening? What can we do about it? And how do we keep going together? This is a space for clarity, strategy, and hope rooted in action. Not denial. New episodes of Assembly Required drop Tuesdays. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts and on YouTube. In moments like these, it's easy to feel overwhelmed and even easier to feel powerless. But we are neither. I'm Stacey Abrams, and on my podcast, Assembly Required, I take on each executive action, legislative battle, and breaking news moment by asking three questions. What's really happening? What can we do about it? And how do we keep going together? This is a space for clarity, strategy, and hope rooted in action, not denial. New episodes of Assembly Required drop Tuesdays. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts and on YouTube.
And welcome back. You're listening to Hysteria, the podcast for people who agree that Selena Montgomery is the best possible portmanteau if you're going to write romance novels. Today, we have a very special pre-election guest, politician, New York Times bestseller, and host of Crooked's Assembly Required, Stacey Abrams. Stacey, welcome back to Hysteria.
Thank you for having me again.
It's been too long, but I'm glad you're here. Biden won Georgia by a razor's margin in 2020, and things are looking pretty close this time around, too. What does voter sentiment look like to you in Georgia right now?
It is incredibly tight. It is incredibly tense. We have a matter of days to save democracy, and people are very aware of it. I will say one important data point is that there was yet another story today of a woman who nearly lost her life because of the abortion ban in Georgia. That's beyond the tragic deaths of Amber Thurman and Candy Miller. And the reason that matters, I think, is that it is focusing the mind on the consequences of these elections. And while we tried to raise that in 2022, it was before these stories were coming out. It was before people realized what it could actually mean. And so I do think we are in a moment where particularly women, but I would say more broadly, Georgians are understanding that there's a direct connection between who holds these offices and whose lives actually count in this country.
Are you hearing from other Georgia organizers, people that you're in contact with in the state, that the level of anger post-Dobbs is, like, kind of sustaining itself? Like, there's been some Pew research that's found that women are still just as mad now as they were when Dobbs came down. Are you finding that that's the case in Georgia as well?
We are. And the reason I referenced 22, so when I ran for governor in 2022, that was a center point of a centerpiece of our campaign. And it was not completely effective, especially with white women. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons was that it was so new and people didn't quite believe that it would have the effects. And that's why these reports, in fact, on our podcast, Assembly Required, we had Kavita Serrana, who broke the story for ProPublica about the deaths of Amber Thurman and Candy Miller. Today, there's a USA Today story about a woman who was having a miscarriage and was denied medical care because the doctors didn't understand what the law would allow. These real stories are focusing the mind and I think ratcheting up the intensity and the clarity about what this means. This is no longer speculation. It is no longer hypothetical. It is real. It is tragic. And it is imminent for even more women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like subtextually a lot of white women especially thought that their privilege would protect them. And we're kind of seeing that nobody is protected from the outcome of these laws. Okay, as of Monday night, the Georgia Secretary of State had reported about 3 million people had voted early, shattering another early voting record. What does this say to you?
So I know what they're trying to say it means, and I want to be really clear about what it says and what it doesn't say. So in 2020, we had two modes of voting that were very effective. You could vote by mail, which millions of Georgians did, and you could vote early in person, which millions of Georgians didn't because there was COVID. Mm-hmm. However, so many people who traditionally did not use vote by mail, namely people of color, young people, disabled communities, people who got engaged in the body politic for the first time, used vote by mail as a medium, and therefore Brian Kemp, the governor, and Brad Raffensperger, the Secretary of State, advocated to shut down that lane of and that modality of voting. So we are seeing identical levels of engagement mm-hmm. that, in this case, are overcoming obstacles and barriers to voter participation. They try to stop these voters from showing up by making it harder to vote by mail. They made certain that there were fewer early voting locations. They made it harder to have, they put these unnecessary ID requirements with vote by mail. There were already requirements, but they added new levels and layers of problems for problems they said didn't exist. All of which was designed, as Brian Kemp said, he didn't like the outcome of 2020, so he passed these laws to make it harder. They thought it would work. I'm excited because it's not working. It's not working because these voters are so determined to be heard that they are shifting their modality of voting. Mm-hmm. But this is not proof that voter suppression doesn't exist. It's proof that voter suppression isn't working as well as they would like for it to work. But that doesn't mean it's not working against some voters. And anytime a single voter or a single community has to work harder to simply exercise the basic perquisites of democracy, that is wrong. And that is why, while we can celebrate the volume, we should not celebrate the victimization of those voters. Mm-hmm.
Stacey, as Aaron said, we're less than a week away. What are you reading? What are you keeping your eye on? Aaron and I are not poll people, but are you reading any polls? Are they telling you anything instructive?
No, polls are okay. At this point, polls are, I mean, it's always a snapshot. And the question is, are you squinting and leaning your head left or right? That's the issue. Because as long as the polls remain within the margin of error, it's just a question of who answered yesterday mm-hmm. and what did they have for breakfast. So we're not learning anything new. I'm watching returns. I'm watching who's actually showing up. Where are they showing up? What's the composition of the electorate? Who showed up before? Who hasn't shown up yet? So, for example, we know Republicans are showing up in higher numbers in early voting. That's either a sign of enthusiasm or, again, a sign of shifting modalities. Because while Republicans worked hard to suppress the votes here in Georgia by limiting who could have access, they've also been running around saying, but please, God, vote early because you guys waited until Election Day. And so we now believe in early voting in a way we didn't before. So they have a lot of Election Day voters who are now becoming in-person early voters. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that there's more enthusiasm. We don't know what it means yet. We just know that they're shifting modalities of voting, so we don't have this groundswell of non-voters. I mean, we have a lot of non-voters who are voting this time, but they were non-voters. So trying to figure out what they are telling us is nearly impossible because Georgia doesn't register by party.
And Stacey, also, like, beyond the presidential race, which we all know is critically important, what other races and ballot initiatives are you paying closest attention to?
So in Georgia, we do not have ballot initiatives. Mm-hmm. That's way too much democracy for us. So what we have instead are state ledge races that I'm working hard. In fact, I'm going to be traveling the state in the next few days, trying to stump for a lot of state ledge races. Georgia's not in a position where if we win these races, we flip either chamber. Mm-hmm. But each time we can claw back more, we get closer to a majority. And I think too often we not only play horse race, we play, lotto. Like, you got to win everything or you win nothing. That's not how politics works. It's not how policy works. We've got to be able to add more people who can stop stupid, at least slow it down, and who can start demanding better. And so I'm looking at state ledge races. I'm looking at county commission races. I'm looking at DA races. Mm-hmm. And all of those matter. And just coming back to the beginning of this, the district attorneys who have to interpret these laws, especially these abortion bans, that matters. So in your state, you may not think that it matters too much, even if you're not in a swing state, but the judge who has to determine if a woman who lives with an abortion ban broke the law or not, the attorney general who's deciding the interpretation of that law, that matters. And so mm-hmm. we need to be paying attention to every single person who has any intersection with the laws as they are passed, because that's going to determine the quality of the lives we live after Election Day.
Mm-hmm. Stacey, on a recent episode of Assembly Required and on other episodes of Assembly Required, you have discussed the maternal health crisis in America, consequences of abortion bans. So whether Harris wins or loses, we know to codify Roe, we'd need 60 votes in the Senate, which without abolishing the filibuster seems pretty unlikely. What do you think the next steps are for organizing to solve these issues?
By showing up in every single state. So this goes out to every person who does not live in a swing state. Where we show up and where we say abortion is an issue we are willing to vote on, it's an issue we're willing to fight on, it's an issue where we're willing to fire you for making the wrong decision. Mm-hmm. That has a remarkable way of clearing the mind. And of those 60 members of the U.S. Senate, many of whom will be up again in 2026, they may not be driven by that issue now, but if they see their friends losing, if they see their colleagues not getting reelected, it's amazing what we can determine in terms of pushing the narrative forward. But the other reality is that between November 5th of 2024 and the next election in 26, we cannot hope that they learn their lesson. We've mm-hmm. got to teach them their lessons every single day. It's showing up in that session. It's showing up whether the issue is tax policy or reproductive choice. We need to show up and we need to remind them of the connective tissue between a woman's right to control her body and every other decision they make. One of the best tools of organizing is to be unpredictable. If we only show up when they know we're coming, they can hide. My point is, we can't let them box us into a certain segment of conversation and thereby evade responsibility. We need to mm-hmm. be everywhere, telling our stories, demanding our rights, and forcing the Congress of the United States to do its job.
So, Stacey, Kamala Harris has been our nominee for just about 90 days, which is insane when you think about it. She came out on fire. One of the things that I always think about is that on the Obama campaign, from which I was day one, it took us a solid 9-10 months to really find our footing and get good at what we needed to be good at. So what is impressing you the most about Kamala's campaign right now?
The consistency of it. Mm-hmm. I was in conversation with someone and they said, well, it was all fire and joy and, it's not. I'm like, you can't be brand new for very long. The question is, what do you do when the shine of news starts to wear off? What's left? And what's been revealed is a solid, strong, dynamic candidate willing to do the work, willing to expand the tent, willing to try new things, knowing that she has had much less time than anyone in recent history to make her case, mm-hmm. going up against someone who is held to no level of and absolutely no standard of accountability. That is to keep your cool and to not be more invective-filled is, I think, a testament to the kind of president that she will be. Because if the disingenuity of her opponent doesn't rattle her, nothing will.
Right. Mm-hmm. And for listeners, God bless, who might still be on the fence, what would you say to them the biggest dangers of a Trump presidency are?
So I like to write. So I wrote a book called Our Time Is Now about democracy. And one of the pieces in the book is about foreign policy, but as a domestic issue. The rise of authoritarianism is rarely what we see at the end. It starts with a candidate who is charismatic, who is coarse, who says things that people won't say and breaks social norms, and he inveigles the population to think that he's some kind of different animal, and that gets people to pay attention. The next stage is that when that person then gets power, they use populism to justify three key behaviors. One, they demonize the press so that you don't trust the news, you don't trust the truth. Secondly, they hijack the judiciary so that the laws that are being made no longer function for society. They function for that person's policies and politics. And the third is that they make an enemy of their own people. You no longer have opponents, you have enemies. And that helps fracture and divide communities, and it makes it harder and harder to build coalition. Donald Trump is a textbook strongman, meaning he is a weak person who is leveraging celebrity and populism to bamboozle, to destroy, and to seize power. But we cannot be so focused on him as the person. We have to see him as an avatar for the people who are emboldening him, who are feeding him information, and who plan to run the country with him as a figurehead and a puppet. The danger of Donald Trump is not what he plans to do. It's what he's willing to let other people do with his permission, because that's the danger. Now that the Supreme Court has said that he is immune from prosecution, what that means is that he will let them run amok and disembowel our democracy, because they will use him as a shill, and he will happily take it as long as someone is looking at him and smiling.
You know, honestly, now that presidents are immune from prosecution, I'm wondering why Biden isn't going more ham.
Seriously.
I feel like he could really be going a little bit nuts during this time of his presidency. Okay, on a more serious note, what is your advice for voters facing long lines, or if they're waiting in long lines, or who are stressed about hearing about ballots being set on fire in the West?
Okay, so one, it is heartbreaking. It is a blatant attack on our democracy. It is not going to work. It's like, anyway, I watch a lot of television, so I was about to do a Good Place reference where, you know, he would just lob a Molotov cocktail and hope that it worked to, you know, change the world. It doesn't. So in this case, what we have to understand is that they're tracking ballots. If you live in a place where this has happened, they know you got a ballot. Double check, see if your ballot was returned. If it wasn't received, reach out, ask for information. Democracy works, and the systems largely work. So let's not let this actually work. It's an act of terrorism designed to scare us out of participation. Secondly, we need to verify where we need to vote and when we need to vote. States like Georgia have changed the rules. It used to be that if you showed up at the wrong precinct, you could vote a provisional ballot. I mean, you can't vote for people who you shouldn't be allowed to vote for, but you can vote for all the big stuff. They've changed that. So if you show up before 5 p.m., they won't let you vote a provisional ballot. You have to go and find your precinct. And if you're there between 5 and 7, you can. The reason this matters is that no matter where you live, if you're in one of those long lines, and you get to the end of that long line and they're like, oops, you're at the wrong precinct, you may not have time to get to the next place. So know what your rights are. Here in Georgia, that means going to peachvotes.com or calling our voter protection hotline, which is 888-730-5816. That's the Georgia one. I encourage Hysteria to give folks the national one. But no matter where you are, if the lines are long, it's because people want to be heard. Please be one of those people who get heard. Number two, know that it matters. These are states where electoral college votes will be decided by a matter of thousands, not tens of thousands, not hundreds of thousands. Georgia, it was 11,779. Arizona, it was 10,000 or so. We need to show up and we need to stay in line. Number three, we need to bring friends. Call people who owe you money, call people you owe money, and say, look, let's let bygones be bygones. We need to show up. But don't vote alone. Make sure that you are doing the work and reach out. And so the three V's I use are verify that you have a plan to vote. Number two, volunteer to get other people to the polls. And then three, make sure that you vote the intentions of the future, not the grievances of the past.
Mm-hmm. All right. One final question. This one's a little bit of a fun one, Stacey. If you had a waiting in line to vote playlist, what tracks would be on it?
Mm-hmm.
So I would start out with Born to Fight by Tracy Chapman. I would do Brave by Sarah Briles. I would let a guy in there stand up because Ludacris is always important on a playlist. I would do some Brandi Clark, Pray to Jesus, or my favorite, Crazy Women. Which is a song that says crazy women are made by crazy men. and I would use the time on my phone as I'm playing to go to fairfight.com/LFGV so I can sign up post-election to help make sure all of this works. And then I'd flip back and I'd find some more fun music to play.
Amazing.
Thank you, Stacey.
Thank you so much, Stacey. And we'll see you on the other side of this.
Yeah.
Thank you, guys. Take care.
Take care.
In moments like these, it's easy to feel overwhelmed and even easier to feel powerless. But we are neither. I'm Stacey Abrams, and on my podcast, Assembly Required, I take on each executive action, legislative battle, and breaking news moment by asking three questions. What's really happening? What can we do about it? And how do we keep going together? This is a space for clarity, strategy, and hope rooted in action. Not denial. New episodes of Assembly Required drop Tuesdays. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts and on YouTube. In moments like these, it's easy to feel overwhelmed and even easier to feel powerless. But we are neither. I'm Stacey Abrams, and on my podcast, Assembly Required, I take on each executive action, legislative battle, and breaking news moment by asking three questions. What's really happening? What can we do about it? And how do we keep going together? This is a space for clarity, strategy, and hope rooted in action, not denial. New episodes of Assembly Required drop Tuesdays. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts and on YouTube.
And welcome back. You're listening to Hysteria, the podcast that would like to point out that Puerto Rico is absolutely not a floating pile of garbage. But maybe if I were Puerto Rican, I would kind of be fine with MAGA people believing it was and leaving us the fuck alone forever to enjoy our beautiful island paradise in peace without them stinking up the joint.
Just let us be.
How funny would it be if that comedian ends up being the reason that Trump loses Pennsylvania? Possibly another state with a significant Puerto Rican population.
400,000 to 500,000 Puerto Ricans in Pennsylvania?
In Pennsylvania, it is a significant population in the state of Pennsylvania, in the Keystone State. I feel like, Alyssa, if Trump loses Pennsylvania and we find out in data after the fact, you know, he's got to lose the whole thing, the whole shebang.
Right.
We find out that the Puerto Rican vote broke heavily for Harris, which we anticipated that it would, but if it breaks more heavily than we would have thought, I feel like we should send him like an edible arrangement.
Of garbage?
I mean, edible arrangements are sort of like pre-garbage, right?
I would edible arrangement him. I do like the chocolate dip pineapples or whatever they are.
Okay, let's get to some announcements for the class before we get into Sani Petty. All right, election week. Oh, my God. It's here. For election week, we're going all in with daily coverage of every race, every count, and every legal curveball. My children are no longer going to recognize me. I'm going to be at the office constantly. What a Day will be fresh in your feeds. Jane Costin will be breaking down what you need to know in 20 minutes. Pod Save America will release new episodes with in-depth analysis of the latest news every morning until the race is called. And in case the Trump campaign is feeling loosey-goosey with their legal challenges, Crooked's go-to legal experts from Strict Scrutiny will stop by on shows across the network to unpack breaking news, plus drop bonus episodes on their feed for those who want more. And, of course, your friendly neighborhood Hysteria is going to be doing
we're
a
here.
Show as usual.
Yeah,
day the after morning the after the. Oh, my God.
Can't wait for the video. We are not getting fancy for that.
We are not getting fancy. Well, nope. Alyssa, I'm going to be here until midnight the night before.
Well, don't forget, I'm East Coast, which means I get 3 hours less sleep on anything that involves a competition.
Oh, my God. Okay, well, that's going to be great. I'm going to be going home at midnight, coming back in at 8 in the morning.
Ish. Yeah.
You know, I don't want to jinx anything, but watch us get a Tuesday night call.
I don't think so.
Okay. All right. Look, if that wild swing ends up being correct, I feel like I need to be officially declared a witch. Okay.
I shall declare you a witch if it happens.
VSA.
This is it. Less than 5 days until the most high-stakes election of our lives, and we're not going to stop bugging you until you convince those around you to vote, because the best messengers at this point aren't us. It's you talking to your friends and family. We need you to think of three people in swing states: Arizona, Nevada, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Georgia, and call or text them now to confirm their plans. No swing state contacts like our producer, Caroline? You definitely know three apolitical people who need a nudge to vote. Use Vote Save America's last call tool for easy scripts at votesaveamerica.com/vote. Pause this podcast right now and text those three people. This is our final shot. This message has been paid for by Vote Save America. This ad has not been authorized by any candidate or candidates committee.
Man, speaking of Caroline, I just remembered that her birthday is 3 days before, or 2 days before the election this year.
Daylight savings.
I would say every single election year, Caroline gets hosed. It's always on or right before or right. It's just, so this next, I feel like next year we need to throw her a double nice birthday.
Yeah.
Because this year is just going to be so fraught. But just wanted to point that out. Happy early birthday.
But now everyone will know it's your birthday.
Happy early
You're
birthday,
welcome.
Caroline. We hope that you are able to compartmentalize enough to enjoy it.
I've dissociated completely.
She's dissociated. Amazing. That's great. All right. Climate is on the ballot across the country. If you care about the planet, the time for action is now. As part of Crooked Ideas' Anti-Doom Initiative, ooh, like the sound of that, Crooked correspondent Priyanka Arabindi sat down with climate scientist Dr. Tekora Jones to talk about the simple ways we can all impact the climate movement, even if you don't have a science background. Stick around to the end of this episode to hear that conversation. And Alyssa.
What?
Alyssa. Me? One more thing.
One more thing before we get to Sani Petty. I got the immense privilege of interviewing the Queen of the House herself, Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and I wanted to share a quick clip of the interview. To hear the rest, check out Tuesday's episode of Pod Save America. And here we are. In 2007, you were elected first woman Speaker of the House. You have been the most powerful woman in politics since, and you made the decision to step down from leadership. It takes women so long to break the glass ceiling. Why did you make the choice? What did you hope for? And were you right?
Well, yes, I was right, of course. But let me just say that it's not a glass ceiling in the Congress.
Okay.
It's a marble ceiling.
Oh, yes.
It's a much tougher thing, obstacle to break. No, I thought it was right. I was excited about it. I don't know. People ask me, was it right? Yes, I was full of excitement about it. The only thing I regretted was that it wasn't going to be in the majority.
Sure.
See, I thought we could win it, even though they said 30, 40 seats was 5 seats. But I stayed in order to make sure that what's-his-name doesn't set foot in the White House again, and to make sure that Hakeem Jeffries has that gavel. But I've been there 20 years. I mean, yep. 20 years, either 8 as speaker, 12 as leader.
Right.
And it's a major responsibility. And, you know, legislatively, politically, fundraising-wise.
Yes.
I was proud of what we had done, but I was glad others were willing to carry the load.
All right. Now let's get to Sandy Petty. Alyssa, what do you got?
Aaron, I don't got a lot. I'm not feeling, aren't we all just kind of getting through it right now?
You know, I've got something I'm feeling petty about.
Here's the one thing I'm feeling good about.
Okay.
Is that, as we know, because we're on a group text all the time, I have not been able to find anything that's soothing to watch. Because, you know, Caroline's recommendations are always true crime, fictionalized or otherwise. And I have been listening to nothing but Terry Gross on NPR. And she had like a really sort of exquisite interview with Bridget Everett about the new season of Somebody Somewhere, which I love. It's mm-hmm. the last season. And both the interview and the series are exceptional and really gave me a little warmth in my heart. So that made me feel good.
You know what? I've been watching Slow Horses like everybody else.
Yeah.
Have you watched it yet?
I have not watched yet, but everyone loves it.
My Josh like devoured the first two seasons within a week. And mm-hmm. then I was like, I'm going to see what all the fuss is about. I was in. Like,
really?
Third
okay,
season,
good.
I was like, I don't know who any of these characters are, and I don't know what they're trying to do, but I'm in. I'm 100% in. Now I'm going to go back and watch seasons 1 and 2, but it is like really enjoyable.
Okay.
Even though it is like a high tension show, it takes place in
that's
the UK.
Okay.
So it's kind of like you feel like you're like, I'm in somebody else's bullshit right now, not in my own.
I'm
country's
fine
bullshit.
In someone else's bullshit.
And it's great. Great performances. A lot of like Gary Oldman is very funny. It's a really good show. But here's the thing I'm feeling petty about.
Tell me.
If you're listening to this, you're hearing it on Halloween or later, right?
Mm hmm. Mm hmm.
I just want to know when Halloween became all about scary carnivals and frightening clowns, because that to me is not the true meaning of Halloween. You know,
no.
Jack Skellington didn't die for our sins for me to go to a scary carnival every time I go to a spirit Halloween. Why? I get it. I understand that Art the Clown, the character from the Terrifier series, which I will never watch because it's too crazy. I get that he's very scary and people are very into Art the Clown right now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why does it have to be all carnival shit? Why is it pointy tooth clowns and the clown?
I mean, clowns to me, separate from Halloween, are very scary. And carnivals also are kind of scary. So for me, Halloween is a much more a Charles Schulz holiday.
Yeah, like I mean,
give me Charlie Brown and Lucy. Let's draw the back of Charlie Brown's head like a jack-o'-lantern. That's my speed.
To me, carnivals say summer. Spring, summer.
That too.
Like, they're not autumnal to me. It's not the right vibe. Like, I think that scary is totally fine, but I think, like, Mike Myers, or I think,
right.
I think about the first season of Scream Queens, which is the only Ryan Murphy show that I've, like, watched and loved. It's the first, like, half of the first season of Scream Queens is, like, so, so, so good. Like, Fear Street, Spooky, like, Christopher Pike books, like, that sort of a thing. Carnivals are not it. It's not the right vibe.
I agree. The only autumnal carnival I've ever seen, I can't believe I remember this, is in the movie Sweet Home Alabama.
But it's not haunted.
Well, it's not haunted. It's just and then there's one in Steel Magnolias too. Mm-hmm. And that's it, but they're not haunted. They're just good vibes.
Yeah, but like a carnival, like a traveling carnival with like it's a midway and everything is like county fair.
That's county fair.
Which is summertime. It's summertime.
It's August, yeah.
This is the wrong time of year. We got to get back to the roots of Halloween, which is like, you know.
I'm with
hay
you.
Bales and
yes.
haunted pumpkins and Samhain.
That's it.
The beginning of the darkest time of the year, you know?
Yeah.
That's just my thought. I'm done with scary clowns. All right. That is all the time we have for this final episode of Hysteria Before the Election.
See you on the other side.
Yeah, we will see you on the other side. Stacey Abrams, thank you so much for joining us. Always a delight to speak with Stacey. Alyssa, thank you for being here with me, with all of our listeners. Listeners, if you want to get in touch, if you want to, you know, share what you've seeing at the polls, if you want to share what's making you happy, encouraging you, you can share what's bumming you out, but we're going to get bummed out too, and that's not the vibe moving into the election. Hysteria@cricut.com is how you can get in touch with us. We will see you on the other side. There will be more hysteria for you next week. Don't forget to follow us at Crooked Media on IG, Twitter, and TikTok. Subscribe to Hysteria on YouTube for access to video versions of your favorite segments and other exclusive content. And if you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping us a nice review. Hysteria is a Crooked Media production. Caroline Reston is our senior producer. Our executive producer is me, Erin Ryan. And Alyssa Mastromonaco is our co-producer. Claire Fogarty is our associate producer. The show is engineered and edited by Jordan Cantor. We get audio support from Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis. Our video producers are Rachel Gajewski and Claudia Sheng. And thank you to Julia Beach, Ewa Okolade, Adia Hill, and David Tolles for production support every week.
Before you go, check out my interview with climate scientist Dr. Tekora V. Jones. This is part of the Anti-Doom Initiative from Crooked Ideas. I'm Priyanka Arabindi, and I asked Dr. Jones about what makes her hopeful in the face of climate change. So you are a scientist by trade. You spent a lot of your career working on policy, trying to tackle really big problems facing us and our planet. What makes you optimistic about our planet and our future?
Well, the thing about going into science and being able to like sit in it is that you have this curiosity that you are always trying to satisfy. The thing that keeps me hopeful about the future in front of us is that it's not just, you know, scientists being curious about what we can do. It's everyone being curious and motivated to act. It's not just about the scientists acting, because if that were true, they would have been listened to in the 80s and 90s, and there would have been collective action around climate.
Right.
That's not where we are right now. And so we just have a fundamentally different landscape where there is much more curiosity, much more motivation for people to be able to act and hold folks accountable for the kinds of things that are going to make our planet better.
What does the science tell us that we should be prioritizing to kind of make the biggest impact on climate change and the effects of it that we are seeing?
We definitely need to prioritize mitigation, getting our greenhouse gases down. And that can be carbon dioxide emission, that can be methane emission. And I think the thing that people want to focus on is that there is a silver bullet. There isn't. There are so many opportunities for us to act across so many different sectors of society. The other thing that I like to say is that it's not about if everyone has a PhD or even a bachelor's degree in a kind of engineering that will then contribute to the technological advances. Ideas are amazing, but at the same time, you actually have to implement them. And to implement those ideas, you need grants makers and people who are going to create and apply for those grants. You need people who are going to be gardeners. You need people who are going to install solar panels. So when people are just like, but I don't have this or I can't, you have some skill that can contribute to the broader revolution that needs to happen for all of us. So why not use that? So it's kind of like find the place to tune in that feels very authentic to you. Mm-hmm. For other people, it is going to be about getting more renewables on the grid. It is going to be about finding the jobs that are putting together the chargers for the electric cars that are going to be powering our future. Because the chargers don't build themselves. You know, for other people, it is about getting involved in global advocacy and action.
What do you think are some of the biggest unknowns that scientists are researching at this point to sort of better understand our planet and the climate?
So I think some of it is focused on how far have we gotten? And if we are able to really mitigate all of the challenges that are in front of us, if we're able to mitigate the greenhouse gases, will we be able to recover some of this? Mm-hmm. Or is it really that we have to lean harder into adaptation and resilience for all of us? It's more that than what science needs to teach us, because we know what we need to do. We don't have to figure out anymore. We just need to act.
What do you say to people who kind of think it's too late to do anything, to act?
Who benefits from you thinking it's too late? You do not benefit when you think it's too late, but there are plenty of other bodies, institutions, corporations, and others who benefit from your inaction because you think it's too late.
Right.
That's what I say.
Heard you loud and clear. Dr. Tecora V. Jones, thank you so much for being here.
Priyanka, it's been a pleasure.
For our Anti-Doom initiative to work, we need more people to know that a better future is possible. Learn more at crookedideas.org. And to make sure that your voice is heard on everything that you care about, please vote.
In moments like these, it's easy to feel overwhelmed and even easier to feel powerless. But we are neither. I'm Stacey Abrams, and on my podcast, Assembly Required, I take on each executive action, legislative battle, and breaking news moment by asking three questions. What's really happening? What can we do about it? And how do we keep going together? This is a space for clarity, strategy, and hope rooted in action, not denial. New episodes of Assembly Required drop Tuesdays. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts and on YouTube.